ॐ स्थापकाय च धर्मस्य सर्वधर्मस्वरूपिणि अवतारवरिष्ठाय रामकृष्णाय ते नमः. श्रुतिस्मृतिपुराणानाम् आलयं करुणालयं नमामि भगवत्पादं शङ्करं लोकशङ्करम्. So we are continuing the discussion. I mentioned at the very beginning that one very important topic discussed in this text is samadhi. So samadhi discussed in this text belongs to two fundamental categories. So in Sanskrit it is called savikalpa and vikalpa. Sorry, savikalpa and nirvikalpa. Savikalpa samadhi and nirvikalpa samadhi. Savikalpa samadhi basically is a practice of sakshi. I mean, practice the habit of looking at things as objects that we watch and see, and we are the subjects, and what we see is the object. Now I can give a few very simple examples as to how this works. Now, you know, in Vedantic tradition, every day, every moment, when we look at an object or when we come to know of the existence of an object by hearing some sound coming from it. For example, when I hear a sound coming from a vehicle running in the street, my mind is dragged towards that object by my ears. If I had seen vehicles, then a number of visual images will be passing through my mind when I think of that object, which is the source of this noise which is coming to my ears. So also when I see a visual object, whatever we see, mind takes that form normally. You can just, for example, you look at a car and close your eyes. So you continue seeing the car. Your eyes are closed, which means the mind has taken that vritti, that visual vritti. So Yoga Sutra calls vritti sarupyam idratra. Unless you practice yoga every day, every moment, our mind assumes the form of the vritti coming from that visual or audio object, any kind of object. Even I see this glass, for example, this cup, for example, if I concentrate on this, my mind is assuming this form. Now, suppose we can look at that object and look upon ourselves as a witness, not as a seer, in the ordinary empirical sense, but a non-participating factor, then mind will not take that form. So this savikalpa samadhi is divided into four categories in this text. Bahya drishyani vidha, Bahya Shabdanuvidha, Andariga Drishya Anuvidha, and Andariga Shabdanuvidha. Anuvidha means it contains. This may look a bit complicated, but it's not at all complicated. And also a process of meditation is recommended here. For example, I can give an example. Bahya Drishya Anuvidha Samadhi. Bahya Drishya means a drishya, a visual object, outside of us. So in ancient times, when this text was expounded, students were taught to meditate on the infinitude of the sky, for example, as symbolic of the omnipresence or all-pervading nature of Brahman. So, am as infinite, as omnipresent as the Akashavat Sarvavyapi. This means, so I am omnipresent as the Akasha. So Akasha is visible outside. So now, normally, when we think of ourselves, we think of ourselves as a physical mechanism with a mind, intellect, and so on. But going beyond that, if we can look upon ourselves as an attributeless, transcendental reality, infinitude, infinite as the all-pervading sky, space. This meditative practice is called Bahya Drishya Anuvidha Samadhi. Bahya Drishya Anuvidha Savikalpa Samadhi. It is one of the subdivisions of Savikalpa Samadhi. After giving an example of this, I can come to the subject. Then there is Antariga Drishya Anuvidha Samadhi, where you look upon the sky, not outside. Antariga means internal. Bahya means external, without, outside of us. So Antariga means internal. Now this all-pervading space is within me. So in actual practice, when a person grows in spiritual life, there is a gradual evolution from many to one, from gross to subtle, from outside to within, and from a reality, a concept of reality with form, towards a concept of reality without form. Without form should not be understood devoid of form, transcending the limitation of form. And this is a very important point to remember for anyone who studies Vedanta philosophy, especially in a very informal way. Sometimes you find in our translations, Brahman is nirguna. Nirguna, and is, it means attributeless, formless, nameless, and so on. It doesn't imply absence of name, form, or attributes. It implies transcendence. And that should be understood. It's a very crucial point. You know, any number of books are written on Advaita. Oh, Advaita, you see, if you don't mind, I can quote an author which you may not please many of you. Aravindu, writing in Isavasya Upanishad, makes a statement which can only, unfortunately, be called ridiculous. What he says is, Shankara's Brahman is inactive like a stone. Now you find in Aravindo's book, Aravindo's Secret of Vedas. So very often, some of the great monks in the Ambangshana order, senior monks, who had occasion to go to Pondicherry, just at the time of, Aravindo's alive, say, see, don't believe that Aravinda was wrong. You should not assume that. The point is, this misunderstanding could occur to many. Why? I can give another example of a very serious misunderstanding. You see, Maya was misinterpreted as illusion. You know, and Swami Vivekananda was the first great spiritual teacher who corrected this wrong notion in his London lectures. One of Vivekananda's most telling contribution, important contribution to Vedanta metaphysics is this, his correction of the wrong notion. Maya is not illusion, Maya is delusion. See, Maya doesn't, you see, optical illusion. There is nothing there. You see something. It's not Maya. Optical illusion is where there is nothing there. You may see something, but it's a phantom. It's total nothing there. Maya is mistaking one for the other. Maya is nothing but mistaking the impermanent for the permanent. Looking upon the impermanent, the momentary, as the permanent and eternal. That's all Maya, nothing more. Maya is not negation of anything. Maya is nothing but seeing the absolute through the glasses of time, space and causation. That's all. Maya is... So, I can give many such examples. So, we should remember very important thing. See, nirguna doesn't mean devoid of gunas. Why? Sri Ramakrishna makes this point very clear. And at the beginning of the gospel, Yam had that mistake, you know. Yam thought, really speaking, Yam said that, I believe in God without form. And he was very particular about it. So then Sri Ramakrishna's correction was, that is true, but you should also believe it is possible that God can have form. Yes, that there can be a God without form, there can also be a form. It is perfectly understood in Vedanta. That's true. So, gunatita or nirguna means transcending gunas. So, if you attribute gunas, characteristics or tendencies, names and forms of to anything, you are limiting it. When you feel form, means it is structured, limited within the framework of that form. If you say, I define, this means you are limiting what you define within a word structure. So beyond definition means it transcends any possible definitions. Beyond verbalization means it transcends that verbalization. Satchidananda, you asked this question this morning. Satchidananda is actually an attempt to explain what is beyond explanation. So you can make an attempt, but the absolute reality is beyond. So transcending means not being devoid of it. In Sanskrit, it's called atitattva and virhotitva. Virhota means conflict. This is nirguna, this is saguna. No, what is seen to be saguna with form now is later recognized to be transcending all possible forms, good attributes, later when you evolve to the next stage of your spiritual evolution. That's all. So that should be understood very, very clearly. So when we first meditate on the infinite, expansive, all-pervading sky, and when we try to get an idea of the all-pervading nature of Brahman as the omnipresent sky, because the sky is visible, it's called Bahya Drishya. Drishya means that which could be seen. Drishya means something seen or could be seen. That's Drishya. So you can see. Now when you think of the same all-pervading Akasha within your own heart, then it is called Andariga Drishya Anividha Savikalpa Samadhi. Again, there is Bahya Shabda Anividha Savikalpa Samadhi. Well, what it means is this. You chant, see, Bahya Shabda means a sound that others can hear, you also can hear. It's called Vaikari. So, you know, every sound, including mantras, can have four dimensions. At the lowest level, very loud. You have seen some bhajan groups, some devotional classics make a lot of noise. It is good, actually. It is good because that's the beginning of approaching the absolute reality. But at the higher level, when you experience and when you realize your identity with what that word symbolizes, then all sounds disappear, sounds merge in silence. So this is one way of meditation. So a person, for example, you can take a great statement from any holy literature, or a verse, or a hymn, a teaching of great teachers like Jesus Christ, Buddha, Siddhartha, Mahasana, very great statements. There are many, many statements in the Upanishads, in the world literature you find. I can give the example, you know, St. Paul's statement, the Jesus prayer. The Russian Orthodox preacher was shouting, but the humble peasant wanted to reach the higher dimension. When you shout, when you hear your voice, it is called Vaikari. The second stage in an ascending order is Madhyama. The third stage is Pashyanti. The fourth stage is Para. So the Para, Pashyanti, Madhyama, Vaikari. In a descending order, these are four dimensions of every kind of prayer, every sacred chant, every sacred recitation. So for a lot of, you hear a lot of noise from the markets, then you have to perhaps shout your prayer, because there is a lot of disturbance. But that's because our mind is not fully focused on it. So we need the help of the audible sound to turn our senses away from the external objects. For that, we need a counter focus. So another, that's why people who shout, you can find, of course, I don't want to name any organizations, you can find all Hindu, Christian, Islamic, Sufi traditions, you find very loud chanting, and they get excited. They get, because the BP goes up sometimes, and they get excited. In a way, it is good, but it is only the primary school in spiritual life. Nothing wrong in it. You have to start somewhere. You have to go to the kindergarten to begin your education. And Vivekananda, in a way, sometimes uses strong language. This is one danger, is this kind of devotional practice shares borders with fanaticism. Because anything that creates excitement, the other side is fanaticism. So there's one aspect. As you evolve further, this prayer or this shabda, this sound, becomes more subtle. You may chant, but not very loudly. Your lips may move. You may hear your own prayer, others may not hear. Because when you read something silently, you are actually hearing it. When you recite a hymn or a poem silently, you are hearing it. Others won't hear, but you are mentally, it's a mental hearing, subtle hearing. That's why when you silently read something without hearing anything externally, you are able to repeat what you read. Because when you read, you heard, or if you close your eyes, somebody says something, you listen, and after 10 years, you're able to reproduce that sound because you are rehearing, because the mind relives, re-experiences the earlier experience of hearing. So at that second level, this sound becomes a more subtle phenomenon. So you go deeper into the meaning. Then Pashyanti is the third state. At that state, you go into a deeper meaning, you contemplate the meaning, the essence of the sound phenomenon. At the highest level, you merge into the essence of that prayer. So, if you want any example, you can see in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, Sri Ramakrishna gives an example. People chanting devotional songs, at the beginning very elaborate, later the sound becomes, the sounds fade away, and finally it becomes silence. So silence is the foundation of sound. At the para level, the highest level, the sound merges with silence. So at that time, the antariga sabdana vidha samadhi takes place. When you hear loudly, bahya sabdana vidha samadhi. These are four types. In brief, now we will deal with some of the subjects on the basis of the text as a whole. So the first verse, if you have in the text with you, is the 23rd verse. Savigalpo nirvigalpo samadhir divido hridi drishya shabdani vedhena savigalpa punardvitha. So first of all, there are two categories, savigalpa and nirvigalpa. And then savigalpa is divided into four categories. One is based on drishya, internal and external, and shabda, internal and external. Drishya means what is visual. There is internal visual and external. And then the other one is based on sound, internal and external. Now, when we listen to our own chant, when we read something silently, you meditate silently on the sacred mantra, sacred hymn, sacred statement from any holy literature, and you don't make any noise, you slowly find we merge with that essence of that sound. Again, I have to give the example that I can give from Christian tradition. I did the only example. You don't find anything in St. Teresa of Avila or St. John. Of course, they talk about prayer. But the most obvious example is again the experience of the Jesus prayer. You find the way of a pilgrim, where the pilgrim actually traveled from the external to internal. There's a gradual evolution, which is very, very, very illustrative in this respect. So, kamadhyas chittaga drishyas tat sakshitvena chedanam dhyaye drishyani vidhoyam samadhi savikalpakaha. So, what is savikalpa samadhi is mentioned here. So, it says, for example, in our mind, kamadhyas chittagaha. In our mind, in our chittam, there are many, many ideas, many desires, and every desire will project in front of us some visual or audio, any kind of images. When they appear in front of us, you should not associate with them. We should not mentally connect with them, with those images. We should not antagonize them. So, it is a very interesting experience. In fact, I think Buddha's discourse on what you call Sati Upatthana Sutta, which is the original source of this mindfulness, actually. Practice of mindfulness as a concept and practice are built upon the foundation of a very famous discourse by Buddha, which is called, in Sanskrit, is called Smriti Upasthana Sutra. Sutra means a kind of hymn on the state of perpetual mental awareness as witness. That text is still available in Kuddhaka Nikaya, one of the Pali canonical literature. So Buddha, in fact, he recommended this, you find. But you find in the Gita and the earlier Vedantic literature, you find. That is, when ideas, desire, anger, emotions, revenge, all these which may emerge in our mind when we try to meditate, you should look upon those internal or external impressions or memories as if they are objects and we are non-participating witnesses. But we are aware of them, but we don't participate in them. You know, even the legal, in the constitutional law, if you are to be considered to be a witness, a legal witness, you should be present when the crime took place, but you should not have any role in that. So, a non-participating witness, that should be our attitude when we meditate, when wrong ideas, wrong impressions come to our mind. So, what happens for that is a very important, of course, these are interrelated. What happens, you know, We should remember everything in this world as two dimensions. We already discussed Asti, Bhadi, Priyam, Satchidananda, the eternal, unchanging, the absolute, and Nama and Rupa, the name and form. So, for example, this table. This table has come from a tree which had life. Otherwise, the tree won't grow. So it had a life, something in it. So from a seed, the tree grows. It takes water, manure, everything, so it grows. So it has life in it. And that life is a dimension of Satchidananda, Asti Bhadi Priya, the consciousness, the awareness dimension. But then the external form, this particular chair, this shape, it comes and goes. If from a carpenter can maybe able to make a chair out of this, the form changes. Then you call it a different name. So names and forms can change, but the essence remains the same. Like that, whenever something we see or experience, if you can look upon them as if we are non-participating witnesses, sakshi, then a lot of anxieties and problems can be avoided. It doesn't mean a kind of insensitivity or kind of running away from reality or some kind of detachment, cold detachment, not at all. Every great spiritual person had a higher spiritual sensitivity. As I mentioned this morning, all the great spiritual teachers in the world has seen were great workers. The sheer volume of physical work they did. Just imagine. I give many examples. Because the world work should be judged not only on the basis of the visual, the tangible, visible manifestations of the result of the work, but also the impact of that work, their work, spread over several centuries and millennia. See, one Christ, Jesus, worked 2,000 years back, and his work still not stopped. He still continues. Or a Shankaracharya, or a Ramakrishna, or the great sages, Buddha, the great spiritual teachers who worked, maybe for a short life, like Shankara. But our work continues. We are discussing Vedanta. It is a continuation of what Shankara did 1200 years back, really speaking. So the work continues. So the work of a great spiritual teacher should not be judged on the basis of the visual work that is tangible and obvious in front of us. Rather, we should take into consideration its impact and influence spread over maybe millennia. That's because this sakshi witness idea may not be mentioned in Christian or Jewish traditions, but the great spiritual teachers could work so hard because they worked as sakshis. Because if you do a lot of work and then you feel I have done a lot of work, then only you get tired. When we do a lot of work and then we feel we have done a lot of work, the second thought makes us fatigued. That's otherwise we won't be tired. If you can look upon your official work as a play, you will never be tired. You have seen children, for example, or professional footballers. They'll be playing and they're tired. But people who work in the IT companies, they may play, they are never tired. So for IT professionals, football is a play. For football people, football professionals, computer games are play. So what we do as a play will never make us tired. It's a hobby for them. So whatever we do can be made into a hobby. This is not an exaggeration. In Vedantic tradition, whole creation itself is defined as a sport, leela. Shankaracharya's Brahma Sutra Bhashya, Lokavat Leela Kaivalyam. I mean, this world, this creation itself is a sport, it's a play by God. You know, if God works hard, a lot of raw materials, he collects, then plans, then he his spreadsheet, then he collects a lot of instruments, then that there is nothing very great about that God. Because he is in need of something. But suppose the God plays, and as a part of the play, the creation comes, then there is nothing strange about it. You when you play, you don't have a plan actually. When you work, you have a plan. When you work with a plan, you get tired. When you play without a plan, you are never tired. What is play for one group of people is work for another group of people. So that's true. For footballers, working out every day for hours for Olympics games is a terrible work. When they get tired, you know, they play computer games. But IT people, when they get tired working 13 hours before the computer, they enjoy when they play football. So their roles are reversed. So when we look upon life and our own activities and our own emotions and feelings without any obsessive attachment, and obsessive attachment is spiritual and psychological enslavement, then everything becomes a play. So that is the psychological aspect of this Savikalpa Samadhi in its four dimensions. So I think I have explained this particular aspect. Now I would like to take up another very interesting subject that I discussed this morning, that is Chitta Prasada. So we have to remember this Chitta Prasada. Samadhi, we should remember Savikalpa, Nirvikalpa. Savikalpa is divided into Bahya Drishyanuvidha and Andarika Drishyanuvidha, and Bahya Shabdanuvidha and Andarika Shabdanuvidha. So when we listen to something in its highest subtle dimension, it is Andarika Shabdanuvidha, means internal. We are concentrating on an internal, on the essence of what we hear. See, we can learn a hymn, it may be pretty long, and then when we sit and think deeply on the essence of that, when we reach its highest peak of concentration, we feel a kind of merging with that essence of it, its highest level. So here you find this Shabda itself takes us to its highest transcendental dimension. I explained this. Every Shabda, Shabda means word. Shabda means syllable or sound. Word syllable, word symbols, for example, mantra. So mantra, at the primary school of mantra shastra, mantra science, you shout loudly. And as you evolve, at the vaikari it is called, and as you evolve further, it reaches madhyama, where you chant, but not too much of noise. Because you are more serious and more sincere, go deeper. When you go still deeper, then you concentrate on the essence of that mantra. And at the still highest level, para level, transcendental level, we become one with, we merge with the essence of that mantra. So you can see in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, he puts in simple language, you know. He says, when the Vaishnava singing bhajans, devotional music, the beginning with the big instruments, they shout, lot of dance. Finally, at the last moment, they can't utter anything. Words merge into silence. So this happens in Drishya Anuvidha Samadhi state levels and also Shabda Anuvidha Samadhi level. Nirvikalpa Samadhi is where there is no focus. You are not a witness, because there is nothing that you witness, that you are a witness of. You are one with what you are supposed to be a witness of. Subject and object are the same. The Nirvikalpa Samadhi. Now again, so I was just mentioning, I will come to some very important themes related to this, that is, how this actually works in the spiritual life of a person. That's what I'm going to discuss now. And I mentioned this morning, when a person reaches this samadhi, the higher level, Sakshi identity, with Sakshi aspect of our personality. One very important characteristic is an enjoyment of an inexplicable inner blissfulness. And that blissfulness is the most complete form of rest. So Vedanta philosophers tell you the most complete and absolute form of restfulness is samadhi, where you are not seeing anything. When you see different objects or when you hear different things, this multiplicity and plurality, a duality, will make us tired and exhausted. When you don't see anything other than yourself, then you are completely in a state of restfulness. And this is in its highest level, it's called Chitta Prasada. Now, this one very simple way of starting our spiritual journey in this direction, let's say in modern times, is to do something good and noble for its own sake without any selfish purpose. So you find people suffering from phobias, anxieties, or depressions, especially manic problems. They are given treatment including work therapy and things like that. It's only a diversion, a postponement of the problem, not a treatment of the problem. But on the other hand, if a person starts doing something noble, something good for others, without any selfish motive, for its own sake, with a total non-attachment, total freedom from any kind of selfish motive, that action will change our mind, and that action will purify our mind. This really happens. So there is no other way to change the structure of our mental system, because we have inherited these vast accumulated tendencies and impressions, not only from this life, but any number of previous life cycles. So that's why psychological problems have no solution at psychological level. To give solution to something, you should be free from solutions, from problems, you know. A doctor who is also equally sick cannot treat another patient. So psychological problems can be solved only from a level which transcends psyche, which goes beyond mind. So here you find, when we do any noble deed, we get the feeling, well, I have done something noble, something useful for others, without any publicity. We are ourselves the beneficiary of that good deeds. In fact, that's why people continue doing unselfish deeds. And this is something very important. It's called Chitta Prasada. Now I'm trying to explain this in the light of a story of a saint in Vedanta Hindu tradition. You know, one of the greatest saints in Hindu tradition during the pre-Shankarite period was Vyasa. He's supposed to be a great author who wrote many marvelous books, including Mahabharata, which in its larger version is more than 100,000 verses. Book is still available. And Bhagavad Gita is a fraction of it. And he wrote many other mythological books. He wrote constitutional books like Vyasa Smriti, which is a kind of constitution, in fact. One of the earliest Vedic law book is called Vyasa Smriti. There are 18 Smritis, of which Vyasa Smriti is one. And he was one of the greatest authors of those days, one of the most reputed teachers and philosophers. This man was suffering from depression. And he was so honored. In fact, many of his own disciples were always in a state of blissful samadhi. But himself was in a very, very, very precarious condition. So one day, he was sitting on the bank of a river. River Saraswati, it is called. At that time, another sage appeared in front of him. The sage's name was Narada. He was a great philosopher in ancient times. So Narada found that this old man was in a very pensive mood. He was a great teacher, philosopher, highly accomplished man. His own disciples were highly respected. Such a man who had absolutely no problem to worry about. But he was depressed. So, seeing this, Narada put one question. Athabi shojasya atmanam agrudartha iva prabhu. Agrudartha, you know what it means? Well, I have not done what I should have done. That's the greatest mental tormentor. You may have trillions of dollars in the bank. Very reputed, lot of friends, lot of all, everything wonderful. But if you do not have the feeling, well, I have done, no, I have not done what I ought to have done. Or it's opposite, I did something which I should never have done. Both have the same effect on the mental system. So akrutartha literally means a person who has done what he should not do, or a person who has not done what he should have done. Nakrudartha iva akrudartha. So, krudartha means the feeling. Krudarthada means, oh, I have done what I should have done. Well, if you look at the great men who made any kind of contribution, you look at Gandhi, Nehru, Buddha, Gandhi, Lincoln, example, Buddha, Christ, anyone you find. You're fighting for abolition of slavery on the one hand, or India's freedom. Many people may not agree with that, but they felt that they are doing something which they should do. So that's what really propels a person to do higher things. They feel that they are doing something which they ought to do. Not that they are obliged to do by law, but as a civilized human being, I am supposed to do this, so I am doing this. When they do that, they derive a great inner peace and a transcendental inner contentment. This is called Kridarthada or Kridagrithida in Sanskrit language. Both are the same. So this Vyasa had that problem. And Narada was surprised. You look like as if you are a Kridartha, a person who feels that he did not do what he should have done. So then Vyasa told him, you are right, I don't know what's the mystery behind me. I always feel depressed and sad, though I have done so much for humanity. He wrote wonderful books. He taught many people. He taught many kings, many emperors, many of his own disciples. And he was unhappy. Then Narada gave him one advice. And that's very important from a spiritual perspective. What Narada tells him is this. See, you wrote Mahabharata and you wrote Vyasa Smriti. You wrote Brahma Sutra. It's called, you know, Vyasa Badrayana Sutra. Another name for Vyasa is Badrayana. Many wonderful things you wrote. And 18 Puranas, Mahapuranas, 18 Upapuranas, 36 huge volumes. Each volume as big as Encyclopedia Britannica. He wrote, this man, old man, philosopher. And he was unhappy. So then Narada told him, well, in all those books, you know what you have done? You have written what is right and wrong from a constitutional point of view. Dharma. Dharma is the central theme of all the Puranas you wrote and also the Mahabharata. Remember, Dharma here doesn't mean Dharma as understood in Buddhist tradition. It's totally different. Dharma in this particular context, in the conventional context of Hindu Puranas, means what you are supposed to do from a conventional perspective, in terms of social acceptability, in terms of civilized conduct. That's what is meant by dharma. And he wrote Mahabharata, the biggest book the world has seen. If you put Homer's Iliad and Odyssey and Virgil's Aeneid put together, Mahabharata is supposed to be 8 times as big as all the 3 books put together. In its largest version, it has got 145,000 verses. Such a huge book this man wrote. But the central theme of the book is dharma. And dharma here means constitutional propriety, legal propriety, and legal propriety is totally different from ethical propriety. Law and ethics do not always go together. Frequently, they pull apart in the opposite direction, unfortunately. So, in the Mahabharata, is a very interesting subject for modern times. You know. In the Mahabharata, for example, you find great villains who justified their own conduct. And they also quote scriptures. They also quote books. Hitler also, if he had a brilliant lawyer in a constitution, in a court of law, he would have got scot-free. So, legal propriety or constitutional propriety or conventional propriety, a propriety in terms of civilized social conduct, may not be ethically and spiritually proper. It may be just the opposite of it. So, Narada told him, this won't do. You should write something which will help human beings to reach their higher transcendental spiritual goal. What you wrote, there is nothing great about it. Because Duryodhana is a villain in Mahabharata. He also is a wonderful, he had his own arguments for all the evil deeds he did. He says, Janami dharmam nachame pravritti, janami adharmam nachame nivritti. He says, I know what is correct, appropriate, but I can't do that. I know what is wrong, I cannot desist from doing that. That is the type of villain he was. And he had his own arguments. And if you listen to him, maybe if you are a weak judge, your verdict will be in his favor. So Narada told him, that won't do. You should write something which should give a clear message for human beings, following which they will reach their highest spiritual goal, so that they will follow their path of empirical life, artha and kama, without following the path of spirituality. For that, you should depict in your book the life and stories and instructions of Lord Krishna, whose life itself is a demonstration of what is spiritually appropriate and also constitutionally right, surprisingly, in different roles. Because Lord Krishna, on the one hand, he was a great philosopher who preached Bhagavad Gita, the greatest commentary on Vedanta. And he was also a diplomat, a statesman, a warrior who fought for truth and dharma. And he was the one who lived all his life for the poor, for the humble, for the deprived, for the marginalized, using modern language. So that is the kind of man Lord Krishna is. Today is Krishna Janmashtami, our calendar here. So Narada told him, you should write a book depicting his life and teachings, because that will give a clear idea to people as to how they should conduct their life, playing different roles, multiple roles in family, in society, in nation. One should be an ideal son or daughter, husband or wife, mother or father. All these roles, I will find a role model in Krishna's life and his instructions, his teachings. You write a book and then you will be perfectly happy. And Vyasa wrote that book. At the end of the Satyam Param Dhimahi, that is the last word. When he finished that last word, that is also part of, Gayatri Mantra, the essence of Vedantic philosophy and Vedantic spiritual tradition. When he finished that, he felt, oh, I have done something. And he slept peacefully that night. So, what happens, this higher philosophy all may appear to be a distant, remote goal, but the path, the road is open right in front of us. That is, we can do all our work, everything, we can give a spiritual orientation, then becomes a road that takes you all the way there. So we'll discuss a connected topic tomorrow. Now we can have interactions. Okay. Yeah. God, oh, God is form and name.
Right, so those are how, in which way the God...
Yeah, I will explain. No.
Which way help the jiva to...
Yeah.
By praying to God,
Maya. So you find here, evolution takes place at the level of spiritual life. We evolve in our own spiritual life from one stage to another stage. To give an example, at the beginning of our spiritual life, we may think, if I read a holy book, if I perform a ritual, if I go to a place of worship, then that is spirituality. And frequently, we may consider that's the essence of spirituality. That's okay. But as we evolve in spiritual life, we find, at the highest level you find, even without reading a holy book, you can turn your mind towards God. So you find slowly we evolve in our life, and accordingly our concept of God also evolves. At the highest level, you find there are people who can feel, who can practice spirituality without any kind of formal rituals. Again, the example, Gandhi. Gandhi once came to a big famous temple in South India, which was a very orthodox temple. We did not allow people of several categories, they did not allow to enter the temple. So Gandhi took up this cause. And he had a, you know, it is called Vaikam, it is called, you know, Satyagraha. Which Satyagraha means is a kind of struggle to force the king and the priest to open the temple to everyone. And this struggle, his agitation, lasted several weeks. And finally, the king and the priest, they all agreed, and Gandhi returned. Gandhi never entered the temple. But the same Gandhi performed this prayer meeting every day evening, outside the temple. But traditional Hindus consider him as a great holy man. So you find here a person who never worried about any external practices of religion, found it's okay if I do something noble and good for others. Because he felt God is present in these deprived, marginalized people who were not allowed to enter the temple. So it is okay to think of God with name and form. There's no contradiction. As you evolve in spiritual life, when your idea of this world changes, when you look upon this world as of no significance, when you think of the spiritual reality as the most significant thing in this world, then you won't worry about the Creator God. Not that you reject Him, you transcend that concept of God. Remember, there is no rejection of any idea. Transcending is the idea. And you find, to give an example, one of the maybe the only possible explanation or parallel concept is Meister Eckhart's idea of super God. Eckhart had an idea of God that goes beyond the Holy Trinity. So he actually was the one who is well known for his contribution to Christian theology. It's called Via Negativa, where he said, God cannot be explained. God cannot be understood in terms of names and forms or attributes or qualities of anything. So if you read Eckhart, you find an approach that is very similar to Advaita, where God, the formless, is not a rejection of God with form. Rather, it is a natural state of your own spiritual evolution. That's all. See, when you begin your education in primary school, when you reach Harvard, you don't reject what you learned in primary school. You are learning more of it. So like that, maybe the one example that you find in the Eckhartian theology, is the 13th century German theologian, whose views, they almost echo some of the statements in the Mandukya Vrishnanta Prakyam, Nagubhagiprakyam, Nubheda Prakyam, Naprakyam. You find God is neither form, neither with form, nor without form. Neither with attributes, nor attributeless. It is something beyond inexplicable. So he says, attributeless doesn't mean devoid of attributes. It means it cannot be explained as God with attributes or without attributes. It is beyond the explanation, beyond definition. That transcendental aspect is emphasized here. So when you transcend, you don't reject anything. You go beyond it. You don't have any conflict with an earlier stage of your own spiritual evolution. You go beyond it. Going beyond is different from rejecting something and taking for something else. Okay.
You don't chant the name of God.
Well, at that time you say God may be called Brahman. The word Brahman is used. Actually, Brahman and Atman, these two terms are used in Vedanta at that stage. In fact, Heckard himself used another term, super being, super God, like that.
I'm coming to that.
Now, it's a very important question he's asking. Please listen. I shall explain. This is very important. Now, the question arises, what will a person do if he realizes the reality of formless God? A God without form, God without attributes. What will he do? That person will, if he goes to a temple, his prayer, his devotion to God will be more intense than a person who has not reached this transcendental level. In fact, Shankaracharya himself, and it's very important for you to remember, Shankaracharya was the first great philosopher who says in the Gita commentary that he says, the highest devotion to a personal God and the highest experience of the impersonal are the same at the highest experience level. At the level of practice, means, methods, it may appear to be different. When you reach the top of the hill, when you reach highest experience, the highest devotee doesn't say, God is sitting in the temple only, not outside. He will understand the God I am worshipping is present in everything. That is a natural evolution of God idea in Vedanta. The reason why this is not well understood in Christian theology is, in Christian theology what happened, you know, anything that apparently contradicted the theological doctrines was rejected as something outside, and it's outside of Christian tradition. That's why, you know, Eckhart disappeared. He was asked to come to Rome, and then on the way he disappeared. He was a Dominican priest, and the popular view is that the Franciscan got rid of him physically. So another example I can give. So I was telling for you, those of you who are interested can keep in mind, in the Bhagavad Gita, there is a verse. Most probably, it comes in the 13th chapter, 10th verse or something. Maicha aninya yogena bhakti ravibijarini vivikta desha sevittum anabhirjana samsadi. This is the subject. This verse tells you what is the purest, highest devotion to a personal God. Okay, what is the unwavering, pure, absolutely pure devotion to God? Shankaracharya says, devotion to God, Vasudeva, this is the Vaishnava tradition, God, without any wavering, without any distraction, without any dissipation, with full concentration on identity, is pure devotion. Then he says, Sacha Jnanam, that is also the highest knowledge. That is also the highest reach of Advaitic evolution. So you find, that's why you find, yesterday I was mentioning this, in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, there is a scene when an avadhuta, a paramahamsa, a wanderer came. For him, everything was God, Brahman everywhere, Atman everywhere. This man, when he appeared in front of the temple, he did not close his eyes. He chanted a devotional hymn And the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna says the whole temple shook because he could identify himself with this God idea, mother, divine mother, with form installed in the temple. So when a person who has reached the highest level of Advaitic spiritual experience, when he practices non-Advaitic, dualistic, devotional religion, his devotional practice will be of the highest type. But the transcendence is a common factor. So that's why you find those who have reached this transcendental level of spiritual practice in any tradition, when they accept another tradition, they will go straight to the top of it. That's what happens. You see, in a person who has reached the highest level of spiritual evolution in one tradition, when he learns another tradition, say great Buddhist monk, let us say, who has reached Nirvana, who has reached highest experience, if he takes a Christian religion, he may go straight to Eckhart. He may not go to evangelicals. For a person like me who is studying Vedanta and Upanishads all my life, I will be more interested in reading Eckhart, St. John of Cross, Way of a Pilgrim. I may not be interested in reading very dogmatic literature because my mind goes in that direction. If I study Islam, I may focus on the Sufi system. So like that, when we reach some level of evolution in one tradition, with full sincerity, then our mind will naturally go to a higher transcendental dimension of another tradition. See, if you have a PhD from MIT, and if you go to India, and if you want to study Hindu philosophy, you may search for the best university. Because your idea of learning philosophy or any subject here is of a very high order, so you look for something of the same level elsewhere. So Sri Ramakrishna, for example, he reached the Advaitic experience. So when the Christian tradition, he say he had a very high understanding of Christianity. Some Christian priests who came to see Sri Ramakrishna found in him somebody like Christ. We may not agree, because in him they found somebody like Christ. Similarly, you find when we reach a very high level, I call it a transcendental level, going beyond rituals, external practices, going beyond, conventional dogmatic ideas, when we reach the core of the universal spiritual teachings of one tradition, then we will naturally connect with the same level of spiritual ideas in another tradition. That's why you find, if you read Eckhart, find many common ideas in Shankara's commentary to Upanishads. I was just quoting now. He was the one who is known to have contributed this theology, you know, via negative. When you try to explain what is beyond words, what is beyond explanation, you use words which are apparently mutually contradictory. So you find in the Mandukya Upanishad, na anda prajnam, na bhagish prajnam, na veda prajnam, na prajnam, na aprajnam, etc. This Atman is neither awareness inside, awareness outside, nor the combination of both, and so on, you find. The idea is, when you exhaust all possible verbal formations to explain something, the ancient Vedic sages are trying to imply that this is beyond any possible explanation, definition, or approximation at the empirical level. That message is sent by using words which are apparently contradictory. The same method was employed by Eckhart. That's how he began. Mr. Eckhart, he was a great German theologian who lived in the 13th century. He, if you want to read his book, you can read Rudolf Otto. In fact, he was practically buried, unknown, for centuries. after his disappearance on the way to Rome, his books were, many of his writings were practically withdrawn, or they were banned by the ecclesiastical hierarchy. And then what happens, you know, Rudolf Otto, who is a famous German theologian, he wrote many books. He played an important role in reviving Eckhart's theology, which is a transcendental theology. It comes very close to Advaitic, non-dualistic understanding of the absolute reality. Okay, now we should give opportunity to others also. Thank you. Yeah. Any more questions from any? Please. So, that's all. But we can ask tomorrow. No, we can do that first. Because we cannot have one there are others who want to ask questions, discuss it. Come on, please.
So I think one of Eckhart's most famous quotes was, "I pray to God to rid me of the idea of God." I have a question. Before I ask the question, I wanted to thank the people who provided the lunch and served it. I think it's always good to do that. You just made a statement about if you were to study Islam, you would study the Sufis, which are known for their heartness, heart-centeredness. And you talked about the prayer of the heart, which is not called prayer of the mind. And it just seems that the Danta talks a lot more about the mind and very little about the heart. I wonder if you would comment on that.
Could you repeat the heart and mind? You say it's not clear.
It seems like Vedanta spends most of their time talking about the mind, intellect. Okay. Very little talking about the heart.
I shall explain this. You know, in Vedanta, mind includes, you find that's a very, it is important for all of, because it gives we may chance to clarify. So in Vedanta, in Vedantic literature, when they use the word mana or mind, they also imply all the other three components which constitute the mental system, which includes the seat of attitudes, emotions, heart also. So this is a particular tool in Vedantic hermeneutics. And those of you who may be interested, those who study logic and philosophy may understand, you know, there is hermeneutics is the science of interpreting scriptures and classical works. Now, in Vedantic hermeneutics, there is one celebrated method by which when they use one word, that also implies all the related things. For example, you find the Upanishads, netram, I mean, the eyes or tvagindriya, the sense of touch, sense of vision, sense of hearing may be used. So Shankaracharya, the interpreter, will tell you it includes all the other five senses also. Like that, in Vedanta and also in yoga and Buddhism also, there is one name is called Antakarana, which in English is translated as internal organs. It has got four departments. The level of speculation of ideas, the level in which you decide as to what an object is, the memory system, in which you accumulate impressions and memories and samskaras, and also the egoity, the ego system. All these four components are included in one word, antakarana. So in Vedantic literature, when the word mana, buddhi, mind or intellect correspond, you know, this is always a problem of translation, you know. Translation of even creative literature is very, very problematic. Translation of philosophy is still more problematic. So, can Critic of Pure Reason translated in Indian vernaculars, can't even run away from it? Because if even a philosophical system like Kantians, which is very modern, 18th century, cannot be translated into an alien language without disturbing, without completely violating the original meaning. And it is much more so when it comes to Vedanta. Because Vedantic literature evolved at a time when language was not so highly evolved, philosophy was so highly evolved. Philosophy and metaphysics were highly evolved, language was not so highly evolved. So they use the same word in different contexts. As a result of this, in Vaidika Vyakarana, what is called in Vedic grammar, there is a celebrated principle. It's actually, that means the meaning of a word should be interpreted according to the context in which it is used, and according to the person who uses, and according to the background in which it is used. So he says, pravaktuhu vaividhyat is prakarana vaividhyacha. That is the meaning. It means, pravakta means the user, the one who speaks, writes. And prakarana means context. So a word can have different meanings and connotations depending upon the diversity of the context and the person who uses it. This is an accepted grammatical principle by Panini, and also the pre-Paninian grammarian called Shagadayana, who wrote 773 sutras on Vedic grammar alone, which Panini incorporated into Ashtadhyayi. You heard of Panini, the great grammarian. So this I know that is in a very short program like this, I cannot go into details, but anyone who feels that this word is not very clear, you can always remember that there is always the problem of a language which is still more or less in its infancy, and the philosophy which is at the top peak of its evolution. That mismatch, imbalance, is the reason why it's happened.
Swamiji, you talked about the non-participating witness.
Ah.
Can you talk about that in the context of a daily life?
Yeah.
When you're dealing with other people,
yeah,
people in your team,
yeah,
kids or other relatives.
Yeah. One important, I mentioned this earlier, you know, frequently, there are many things in the world which we know to be impermanent, changing phenomena, coming and going. But frequently when we encounter a problem or a situation, we sometimes wrongly assume that it is a permanent phenomenon. Whether your job security or job insecurity or any ill health or loss of money, many of the problems of discipline of kids and children and all this. Frequently, when we get overworked, when we become too much excited, worried, or anxious about this, we should remember that state of affairs is a fast changing, moving phenomenon. It doesn't mean that we should ignore or that we should be indifferent towards it. We must work towards a solution. We must try to rectify the problem. But frequently, you know, when the anxiety or the concern go beyond a limit, that's because we wrongly assume that this unpleasant situation is a permanent state of affairs. So that's a very important principle. And you remember, witness never changes. What he witnesses will change. So the subject remains the same. The objects go on changing. So suppose if we can look upon all these experiences, all the pleasant and unpleasant experiences in day-to-day life situations, which create a lot of anxiety, concern, sometimes reaching the pathological level, very rarely, very frequently, then we should remember it is not a permanent state of affairs. We thought, of course, becoming complacent or indifferent or negligent towards that. We should work on a solution, but at the same time, we should remember it is a passing phenomenon. That is a fact we know very well, but we forget at the moment when we get overworked, when we become too much concerned. I'm giving the example of a person going to the airport, getting caught in a traffic jam, and he's sitting comfortably in a car, and he worried and concerned. So the worry, excitement, and concerns, all this will aggravate the BP, the stress level, everything. But that doesn't in any way help him to reach the airport 1 minute earlier. He knows that, but he gets overworked. So in life also, if you can remember this, the transitoriness, the momentariness of the objective phenomena. That's one way. And that will help us to look at things with a kind of, with some kind of a detachment. Detachment doesn't mean aversion, kind of non-attachment. Of course, without becoming insensitive or negligent or lazy. That's about it. Okay?
Yeah. Swamiji?
Is there a connection between there a connection between the subtle form and the Hiranyagarbha? Subtle form and the Hiranyagarbha, is there a connection between them?
Hiranyagarbha is considered with the cosmic sukshma sharira. It is the cosmic samashti, the samashti dimension, the holistic, the samashti dimension of the sukshma sharira is called Hiranyagarbha. So all the sukshma shariras, individual sukshma shariras, in a way constitute one or other aspects of the samashti sukshma sharira. That's why frequently you may call it a miracle, or you may call it maybe totally unreliable. You know, people who can communicate with other people's minds, telepathy, which is maybe pure. I'm not a believer in this, but I do not disbelieve either. I don't disbelieve, but I don't have any clear idea of what this is all about. Anyway, the concept is there in Vedanta also. So if a person, for example, practices yoga, especially practices samyama. Samyama means, dharana, dhyana, samadhi together. Then what happens, you can empty your mind. Then with that mind which is completely freed from all vrittis, if we focus on something, it can reveal the subtle aspects, like our own previous life cycles, what is going on in other people's minds, and so on. That's because there is one integrating, unifying thread that connects and integrates and unifies the whole cosmic energy system. So that whole cosmic energy system as a whole is called Hiranyagarbha or Samashti Sukshma Sharira. That's another word for Hiranyagarbha. Indeed. Anyway, this is what I said just now. It is not, you should remember the telepathy and all. I don't believe, but I do not disbelieve either. That's it. I won't repeat that again. Okay. Well, please.
I thought this gentleman had a wonderful question about how to handle situations at work and with other people. And I was thinking that if we identify ourselves with the eternal witness, the eternal witness can see through, can see beyond what the senses can behold. And the eternal witness can see the underlying harmony and goodness and perfection that the senses can't take in. And I was also thinking the word identify is so helpful for many of us, to just try not to identify with what we see, if it's some discord at work or in the family, to just see that that is not a part of the person that we are beholding, to separate the person from the problem. And what seems to be so apparent. And so it's that eternal witness that is always seeing Brahman and the Atman, and we just have to keep identifying, as difficult as it is, keep identifying who we're seeing with the Atman and ourselves as true. The witness
to. Correct. No, that is true. That is true. Instead of identifying ourselves with this psychophysical mechanism which is seeing this and affected by this experience, if we can delink ourselves from this visual experience phenomena, at the same time be aware of it. So to be witness, you should be aware of it. Then only you can practice witnessship. Otherwise you'll be caught. So at the same time you should be non-participating witness.
You're aware of it and you're not aware.
We are aware of our real nature, which is not part of it. That awareness alone can help us to practice non-attachment. Otherwise, we'll be caught. You want to understand?
Earlier, I think most of the questions were about non-participating witness.
Yeah.
And I remember you mentioned that at one level, the highest form of it, you said, is you are your own witness.
Yeah.
I didn't understand that.
Okay. Part. Well, I tell you, this is true. Now, when we practice meditation, any spiritual practice, I mentioned this earlier. At one point, as I mentioned, a higher spiritual possibility of ourselves presents itself in front of us. To explain this, for example, when you meditate, when you try to transcend or go beyond our own mental system, our own psychophysical mental system, going beyond it, we are convinced, or there is a possibility for me to go beyond the present me. There is another higher me possible. I can have another higher dimension. There is higher possibility for me to become. But now it's only a concept. So when you really reach and progress towards the higher possibility, our own higher possibility, the lower dimension is left behind, we become one with the higher. You know, the bird that reaches the top branch realizes, well, I and this branch are the same. Then he doesn't eat any more fruits. So when we progress like that, you'll be able to throw the flashlight into your own mental system. At that time, you find, oh, I'm actually getting angry without any reason. I should not be. See, when you are aware of the fact that you are angry, when you become a witness of your own anger, anger disappears. Because then you don't identify yourself with the anger. That's why you are becoming a witness of your anger. When you are a witness, you are not participating. So also, when we feel unnecessary hatred, aversion, irrational fear, and so on, when we become aware of the irrational nature of this fear, it disappears. When we become aware of the problem actually disappears. At the mental level, at a physical level, you have to solve the problem after becoming aware of it. If you don't have a job, there's a problem. You have to get a job, then only it's solved. But the psychological level, when we become aware of a problem, the problem is as good as solved. It, at least it may be a problem, it won't be a big dilemma. The gravity of the problem will be radically reduced. So, for example, a person is unemployed, looking for a job, and he becomes excited. If you meditate, if you think for some time, then you become aware of the fact many people lose their jobs. They also get another job. So I'm not different from them. So your whole perspective towards your own problem is gone. When you objectify your problem, you are the subject, the problem becomes the object that you witness. Then it's no more a serious problem. So at the mental level, a problem is not a problem when you become aware of it. Just like, you know, give the most common example is traffic jam. Suppose you are running, you are driving in one direction, your GPS system shows the 10 minutes delay, and you reach the point, you may sit for some time and read something for 10 minutes, you know it. But suppose you are not aware of how long you have to wait, and you didn't know there was a traffic problem, you may think this traffic problem may last for 3 hours. You start cursing the government, cursing yourself, cursing the whole world. But suppose you know it's only half an hour delay, 10 minutes delay, then you take it a part of the game. It's no more nor a problem. So awareness actually reduces the gravity, the intensity of the problem, the psychological level. Now we will stop and we will continue the last session tomorrow, again from 10 to 11:30. And then from 11:30 to 12, refreshments. 12 to 12:30, meditation. And then the retreat comes to an end this year. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Hari Om Tat Sat. Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.